Thank you. Well, in preparing for this talk, I thought a lot about how I might address the question of how communists view religion, its role in society, and our relations with people who are and are not religious. Everyone knows, or at least most people do, that communists are atheists. That's sort of a basic defining quality of communists. We don't believe in God. But the questions of why and how do we see addressing the needs that many people feel religion can address and give some answer to? And how do we see relating to other people who may be religious but stand on the side of the oppressed in the fight against injustice? These are big questions which need to be spoken to. Now, in trying to think about how to get into this, I thought, well, maybe I could just repeat a line from a recent movie and let it go at that. There was a movie out within the last few months called The Big Bounce. It's not a very good movie. It's got a lot of problems. It's sort of a B-grade comedy caper movie. But it has one of the best lines I've heard in a movie in a long time. Morgan Freeman plays a corrupt judge in Hawaii in this film, and Owen Wilson plays a con man who's not very good at it. And at one point, they're discussing a scheme and having a talk about the problems, and Owen Wilson says to Morgan Freeman, well, how are we going to deal with this? And Morgan Freeman says, you just have to have faith. And Owen Wilson looks at him and says, you mean in God? And Morgan Freeman's character replies, God is just an imaginary friend for grown-ups. And they liked that line so much that it got repeated again in the movie. But as we know, it is more complicated and more serious than that. And we need to dig into this whole question more deeply. To begin doing so, let me tell another story about a comrade of ours whose family is from Mexico. And recently, before his mother died, she came to this country when she was very young from Mexico, was from the peasant countryside and deeply steeped in the Catholic religion. And they went together to see an exhibit of Mexico from ancient times and the Aztecs up to the present day. And they walked through the first part of the exhibit, and there were all these artifacts and things from the period of the Aztecs, all their religious symbols and other things that they used in their culture and their religion and so on. And they went through this one after the other after the other. And then at a certain point, they got to the point where the Spanish conquerors, the conquistadores, had come to Mexico and imposed the Christian religion. And there was a big cross right there which began this section, Mexico after the Spanish conquest. And this comrade turned to his mom and said, who recalling her very deep Catholic religious faith, and said, you see, Mom, if those people, pointing to the Aztec exhibit, had won instead of the Spanish, you'd be worshiping these gods instead of that one. And this gets at a very deep reality. Why are different religions practiced in different parts of the world? And why have religions changed from one era to another in the same part of the world? Because different conquerors have come through, overthrown and replaced the old rulers, and replaced the culture that they carried forth and imposed on the society with the new culture that the conquerors brought. That's why you could have the Crusades, which I'll talk about a little bit more, back and forth, where Islamic empires and Christian empires were fighting each other for many things, including, crucially, the control of that key area of the Middle East, as we call it now, and also seeking to impose their religion. And where one won out, Christianity, for example, would be imposed. And where the other won out, Islam would be imposed. And then, over centuries, the people deeply imbibed these religions. They went deep into the quote-unquote souls of the people, and people naturally believed this, and just approached it without even thinking, as if, of course, this is the truth that's been handed down since the ages from an all-knowing, all-powerful being, whether Allah or Yahweh. To try to break through on this, recently there was this whole thing around the Mel Gibson movie, The Passion of the Christ, and the cross and the crucifixion was the defining and central symbol of this movie. and the suffering of Jesus on the cross went on and on. I admit I didn't see the movie, but I know about it. And the cross, the suffering of Jesus on the cross went on and on and on. Well, now here's a question. Why is the suffering of Jesus on the cross a big symbol in this whole culture and not the suffering of Spartacus and all the other slaves who rose up with him a little less than 100 years before Jesus, all of whom were crucified down the road from Rome for miles for daring to rise up in rebellion against the Roman Empire? There's one fundamental reason why the crosses and the image of the crosses of Spartacus and the slaves who rose up with him are not big cultural symbols and icons in our society, and the crucifix of Jesus is. Because the people who ruled the societies we've lived in and the ones that preceded them going back to the Roman Empire almost 2,000 years ago have upheld and utilized Christianity for their purposes in ruling society all this time. And we've been indoctrinated with the symbols of this one cross, but not with the symbols of the slaves rising up, because that's the last thing that they want to celebrate or call people's attention to and have people think about. Or let's look at it from another angle. In New York City, you have the Lubavitchers, a fundamentalist sect within Judaism. Not too many years ago, their leader, Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, died. And it was a very interesting phenomenon, the whole thing that went on, where, you know, there was a debate among all his followers, which is still continuing after his death. Was he actually the Messiah? Because, of course, in Judaism, they don't accept Jesus as the Messiah. That's the fundamental split between Christianity and Judaism. So the debate was going on, is Rabbi Schneerson actually the Messiah who's finally come? And there was a whole comical aspect to this where sort of the advanced technology and very backward ideas were combined together, where all the people, or not all the people, many of the people in this sect were on their cell phones and their pagers waiting to hear the word if it was finally declared that Rabbi Schneerson was, after all, the Messiah. So here you see very backward ideas combined with very advanced technology. It's a very common phenomenon, including in the White House of this country. But what if, let us say, somehow some ruler came to power in the United States or some other powerful country and decided that the religion of the Lubavitchers would serve his purposes, the way Constantine did about 1,700 years ago in Rome, and I'll come back to that. And what if, therefore, Lubavitcher religion and Rabbi Schneerson as the Messiah became the dominant idea, the dominant religious principle in that powerful society, and through force of arms, they spread that all over the world, defeating other armies and imposing that religion on people. Then all over the world, this idea that we laugh about now, Rabbi Schneerson as the Messiah, would be deeply and religiously held with great awe and reverence by billions of people all over the world. Or take another example. Haile Selassie, who was the emperor of Ethiopia until he was killed in the 1970s. He is the central figure of the Rastafarian religion, which is based mainly in Jamaica and the Caribbean. They regard him as a divine figure. I remember seeing a program on Bob Marley where when Haile Selassie, who used to be called Rastafari before he became emperor, came to Jamaica and thousands of people thronged there to greet him as a conquering divine hero. And he, all of a sudden, despite all the publicity he'd done about himself, got very nervous and wouldn't get off the plane for a while. But finally, they coaxed him off the plane, and there was all this deeply religious awe spread around. I remember seeing in this program on Bob Marley this one woman talking about how she saw on his body the signs that he was the divinity, which she totally imagined. But she was firmly convinced of this, and you could not have ever convinced her that she hadn't seen these marks on his hands that proved he was the divinity. And, you know, ironically, you have this Bob Marley song, Redemption Song, which has the lines in it, "Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds." It's very ironic because this is an advertisement or a promotion of Rastafarianism, which most people in the world reject, and which in fact is ironically another mental slavery imposed on the people. Or let's look at the Mormons. One time I gave a talk and people said, quit picking on the Mormons, but there is something worthwhile looking at in terms of the Mormons. Now, Joseph Smith lived on a farm in upstate western New York, somewhere near Buffalo, back about 200 years ago. And he had hallucinations and imagined, or unless he's just outright making it up, but let's say he's honest and he had hallucination and imagined that he was visited by this angel Moroni that nobody had ever heard of before, who guided him to some buried plates on which was written a whole history of people who'd broken off from Israel about 500 years before Jesus and were lost tribes here in the United States. And ever since then, Mormons, and you know, over the last 200 years, have been carrying out geological studies and going out and excavating to try to see if they can find any evidence of these tribes of people who came from Israel 500 years before Jesus. Well, it's a very unfortunate thing for them. It's a fruitless labor. They're never going to find any such things because they don't exist. But right now, Mormonism is one of the fastest growing religions in the entire world. They send missionaries everywhere. You may have seen them. They come to your door dressed in black, riding their bicycles and so on. And very interestingly as well, and insidiously, very dangerously, the Mormons put a very high percentage for their numbers into things like the FBI and the CIA, because they're a very fundamentalist conservative religion. They don't believe, for example, that women should have the right to abortion because they believe that all souls are already existing and just waiting for their bodies, so you might kill off some soul's body by having an abortion. But they have a large number, relatively speaking, to their relatively small numbers, a large number of people in the FBI and the CIA. Well, let's suppose they actually, you know, didn't just have, you know, Hatch, the senator from Utah, but they actually took over the whole government of the U.S. Well, then everybody would start becoming Mormons. And given that the U.S. is a worldwide empire, people all over the world would start advocating Mormonism and be indoctrinated with Mormonism. So I think you see my point. If you look back through history, slave masters gave Christianity to slaves, Islamic conquerors imposed and indoctrinated the people that they conquered with Islam, and so on all over the world. This is the way religions have been spread, not by the power of their word, but by the power of the sword, the gun, and the missile. But beneath this, there are some deeper questions that people raise and wrangle over and philosophize about and think deeply about. Is it possible to be good without God? Is there some deep inner human need for God and for religion? Can there be a meaning to life without belief in God? Now, as we know, religion and Christianity in particular and communism give very different answers to these questions. And that's a lot of what I want to speak about tonight. But let's step back and try to get a sweeping view of all this. Throughout the world, and going back in history, people in ancient societies and people without a scientific approach to studying, engaging, and changing reality, people who have not yet developed or have been denied access to such a scientific approach, or people who have resisted and rejected such an approach, these people have brought forth and rallied around various myths in the attempt to develop a meaningful story of how they came to be, of the reality they experienced, of the larger reality they perceived, and of how they wish reality to be. They have treated these myths as the defining elements of reality. In actuality, these stories were not and are not a true description of reality, of history or of nature, or the development of human beings and of particular peoples and their relation to the rest of humanity and to the natural universe. They were not and are not, in fact, timeless and enduring truths handed down or inspired by some supernatural deities, gods, or by one all-knowing, all-powerful, supreme being, one God, who surpasses all human existence and knowledge while ruling the entire universe. Religious stories and scriptures were and are precisely rooted in myths, fanciful products of the human imagination, attempts to explain things which people could not accurately, rationally, and scientifically understand and explain to others at the time. And in this connection, it's worth thinking about the fact that the great majority of all the scientists who have existed in the history of humanity are alive today. In other words, most of the history of humanity has been marked by the absence of an all-around and systematic scientific approach to understanding and interacting with reality, including the reality of human societies and their historical development. But that is not all. The explanations based on myths that religion attempts to provide for seemingly mysterious aspects of reality and for the larger and defining principles of reality, these are not just wrong in some neutral sense. They are not harmless. They do great harm and cause a great deal of anguish and suffering. Let's look at a few examples from the Judeo-Christian tradition. Today we know, for example, scientifically what the causes of epilepsy are, how it comes about, and how to treat it. But back a few hundred years, and certainly at the time of the Bible, for example, or the time of Jesus, this was not understood. And people then, as many people still today who have not been able to gain a scientific understanding, regarded this with a great deal of fear. They look at someone shaking and quaking, having a fit, and they think it's something terrible going on, and even that it's some kind of demon or devil possession. But this is actually what's put forward in the Bible. For example, specifically speaking of epilepsy, this is attributed to possession by demons or devils. You can look, for example, at Matthew in the New Testament, chapter 17, verses 14 and 20, where Jesus supposedly cures a boy of epilepsy by casting a demon out of him. And I'll have more to say about this kind of thing a little later, too. Or look at the creation mythology in Genesis, the first book in the Bible. And that's what it is. Navajos, people in Africa, people throughout Asia, have all the different peoples, the indigenous peoples, have creation myths telling the story from their viewpoint of how they came to be and how they relate to other people. The book of Genesis, and in particular the in the beginning and so on, the creation story, is the creation myth of the ancient Jewish people. It's that and nothing more. And it's all, of course, all tied up with Adam and Eve and the fall of man and, of course, the special curse upon woman for bringing about the whole fall of humanity. The story of the weakness and treachery of Eve in the Garden of Eden, who could not resist the temptations of devils and bit into the apple from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and then induced and seduced Adam to do the same, and then it's the terrible, tragic history of humanity ever since. You can look at this and see how it's spelled out in Genesis, particularly chapter 3. And in that Genesis chapter 3, you will see that a curse is put upon not only Eve, but all women down through time because of Eve's role in all this, a curse that they will particularly experience in bitterness and pain in childbearing and childbirth. And in the world today, there are many women who are still under the sway and the weight of this who believe that this is a curse upon them, along with many other normal bodily functions which are cursed and cast as bad things in the Bible. And I'll get to that too. And we find this isn't only something in the Old Testament. This is upheld by Paul, who is actually the central figure in Christianity and whose ideas dominate the New Testament. He upholds this curse upon woman and refers to it, for example, in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 8 to 15. Or look at the story of Noah's Ark and the supposed great flood. Newsflash, there never was such a flood. There never was a flood that covered all of the earth. There is absolutely no indication or suggestion of that from any source other than the Bible. In all the historical records, in all of the archaeology, and all of the digging that's been done and all the examination of civilizations that existed at that time, from Egypt to the Mayans and Mexico, there is absolutely no indication that there was any kind of geological disturbance that would have been caused by a flood that covered the whole earth and lasted for 40 days and 40 nights. And there's no indication of any interruption in the civilization of all these people all over the world during that time, which certainly would have been caused by a flood that covered the whole earth for 40 days and 40 nights. This is a myth. It has no basis in reality or history. And upholding this now, especially upholding it as literally true, is to uphold and promote superstition and ignorance of how the world really is and how it has developed and changed throughout its real history. And it is to promote all the suffering that goes along with and is reinforced by this superstition and ignorance. These fables and other similar stories in the Bible were part of what came to be crystallized and set down in writing as the ancient Jewish scriptures, or the Old Testament of the Christian Bible. But these scriptures were not just the embodiment of different myths and attempts to explain reality in the abstract or without social content. They were and are the reflection of the human societies in which these myths arose, and of the relations among people in those societies and between them and other societies, and the ideas that go along with and reinforce those relations. And once relations of exploitation and oppression, of domination of the means to life and of political power and intellectual life by a small group or class of people, once this arose in human society and human history, religion has been used by the ruling classes throughout history to enforce and extend those relations of oppression and exploitation and the systems that embody them. As a leaflet put out by our party on the movie The Passion of the Christ summarizes, quote, "Not only is the Bible not literally true, not only is it a book full of what can charitably be described as a hodgepodge of remarkably violent legends, tall tales and tribal history, interspersed with a little lyric poetry, a lot of revenge-filled fantastical rants, and some origin myths," and we'll get into all that too, "but these were all told and then set down in writing in order to reinforce, first, a patriarchal desert agricultural society several thousand years ago, then a slave empire in Rome, and then an oppressive feudal society in Europe, with landlords and serfs. It is filled with codes of behavior that are either hypocritical or openly oppressive. Now this same ancient stuff is being adapted to reinforce the capitalist oppression of today in a $25 million cleverly promoted Hollywood film. We don't need this. But the ruling classes do. And here I'm reminded of a statement by Napoleon, who rose to power in the aftermath of the French Revolution about 200 years ago. Napoleon put it out very bluntly. He said, "Society is impossible without inequality. Inequality is impossible or cannot be sustained without a morality to justify it. And morality, in turn, cannot be sustained without religion." This also reminds me, going back to this movie and the book Spartacus, there's a scene in the movie Spartacus, the original, where Kirk Douglas plays Spartacus, where one of the characters, who's a Roman ruler, a member of the Senate in Rome, the ruling Senate in Rome, played, I believe, by Charles Laughton, the British actor, is asked by another senator, "Well, don't you believe in the gods?" And the senator replies, "Privately, I believe in none of them. Publicly, I believe in them all." The point being, he knew better, but it was useful to the ruling classes to impose this on the slaves and other exploited people in the Roman Empire. And this also reminds me of Ronald Reagan. Since we're now being hit with a deluge of defecation praising Reagan, let me say a few words about him. Because he was a president who, and of course many of the people in power in the Bush administration now worked for him and first got their start there, but he was a president who played a big role in promoting religion You know, it was with Reagan in particular, there's this whole ending every speech with God bless you and God bless America really took off to another level. He wasn't the first, but he did a lot to promote it. Now if you excuse me, and I hope you will, I want to just say a few things here. I want to take off on Ronald Reagan for a little while, since we have to hear all this shit about him all the time. All these people who admire Reagan and are turning him almost into a holy saint tell us that he won the Cold War. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. Or was that Nixon? But anyway, this is what Reagan said. And yes, the U.S. forced the Soviet Union to back down and end up disintegrating. But at what cost? We were dragged to the brink of nuclear war. That was the basis on which, quote-unquote, Reagan won the Cold War, building up the military to incredible levels and doing a lot of horrendous things with it, which I'll get to in a second, and threatening nuclear war. Remember his joke, quote-unquote, when he was, quote-unquote, not yet on the air, we begin bombing in 5 minutes? Well, who thinks that's funny? And this was the cost that we almost had to pay. This is the brink we were dragged to by the great, avuncular, kindly Ronald Reagan, as he's being repackaged. But that wasn't all. Look what Ronald Reagan did in Central America, particularly in Guatemala, but also against the people of Nicaragua and El Salvador. Hundreds of thousands were slaughtered. The U.S. funded, organized, trained, and set loose on the Nicaraguan people a group called the Contras, who set about attacking farms, health clinics, community facilities, and destroying them and killing people, as well as bombing things like the harbors of the country. They set loose a military in Guatemala, which went literally from village to village to village, lining up all the people, killing every male of fighting age because they were guerrillas and they didn't want the guerrillas to be able to recruit them, raping the women repeatedly, and then, yes, literally, taking all the babies down to the streams by the village and bashing their heads in. And for part of this time, a Christian fundamentalist, Rios Montt, an officer in the Guatemalan army, was the president of that country, who was praised lavishly and prayed for openly by people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and all those people who are now associated so closely with Bush. Or look at what happened in Africa under Reagan. We all heard about Rwanda and the terrible tragedy of hundreds of thousands of people slaughtering each other there a few years ago. What we've heard much less about is not a spontaneous or perhaps, low-level organized, but largely a spasm of violence among the people that spent itself in a few months, although killing hundreds of thousands of people in horrible ways. But what we had, for example, in Mozambique was an organized, trained, and led effort by one of the most despicable groups that ever has existed on the face of the earth, called RENAMO, which would kill and mutilate people who were supporting the government that the U.S. wanted to oust from Mozambique, and who would go repeatedly and in an organized way into hospitals and kill and maim people already wounded or sick in hospitals. And this, Ronald Reagan praised them as great freedom fighters. And finally, I could go on and on, but we should get back to our main subject. I could go on and on about Ronald Reagan, but let me just point to one little thing that really gets to the character of this man who also publicly promoted religion so much and is now being reinterpreted as a kindly uncle for all of us. I lived in California in the 70s when the Symbionese Liberation Army kidnapped Patty Hearst. Now, the Symbionese Liberation Army was not really a revolutionary force. Their strategy was no good. What they did wasn't going to lead to any kind of revolution. But in the course of this whole thing, at one point they'd made a demand on the Hearst family, which is a very wealthy family, that they fund food for the poor in California. This is part of the demand to get their daughter, Patty Hearst, back. And so the Hearst family agreed, and they set up these distribution centers at supermarkets and other places throughout California where poor people could come and get free food. And Ronald Reagan got up and said, in the face of this, I hope there's an outbreak of botulism. That's food poisoning. Now, by what possible means could you think, whatever you think of the SLA and of the whole kidnapping of Patty Hearst, what could possibly possess a decent person to say that they hope there's an outbreak of food poisoning when poor people are getting food distributed to them? And who could possibly think, if they say, oh, that was just a joke, who could possibly think that's funny? So enough on Ronald Reagan. Let's get back to more of what Ronald Reagan upholds in an overall sense. Returning to the Bible, there's no way to get around, if you read the Bible, the horrendously oppressive relations that are upheld and even commanded and even celebrated in the Bible, in the New Testament as well as the Old Testament. Slavery and other forms of ruthless exploitation are extolled and upheld in the Bible. The oppression of women, even including the quote-unquote right to carry them off as prizes of war, rape them, and make them concubines of the conquerors. The condemnation of homosexuality as an abomination deserving of death. The right and indeed the duty to plunder and slaughter people following other religions, and on with many other cruel and brutal forms of oppression that the Bible insists must be done. If you don't believe me, and I'm going to quote from it, I have my Bible here, read the Bible again yourself, because many people have read it without really understanding what they're reading. But let's come at this again. I'll come back to this some more later. But let's come at this again from a different angle. Let's talk about Christianity in particular and the New Testament. In a certain sense, the essential message of the Christian religion could be said to be put forward in John 3:16. Now, many of you may have seen these football games that are sporting events where somebody scores a touchdown and then they're about ready to kick the extra point over the goal post, and there's some idiot back there with us holding up a sign that says John 3:16. Often he's got a stupid wig on his head or something else. Well, this refers to the following from the Bible. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him shall not perish, but shall have eternal life. This is very much to the heart of even the better interpretation of Christianity. So let's dig a little bit into this and see what it's actually putting forward and what it's actually based on. First of all, let's go back to Genesis in the beginning and the myth of the fall of man and the view of humanity and the fate of humanity that this puts forward. This is what is being reinforced in John 3:16, the view that humanity is fundamentally flawed, that it's fallen, that it can not come to any good or bring any good into the world on its own and can only bring evil and horror into the world without God. Otherwise, there would be no need for God to send his quote-unquote only begotten Son to save humanity. So this is a very negative view of humanity and the possibilities and potential of human beings. Along with that, this is a view that puts forward patriarchy, the view that men should be dominant in society, and indeed that men are the only ones who really count. Why do I say that? Well, think of the phrase that begins, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son." Now, this is clearly a human view of a patriarchal society where sons count and daughters do not. That is why gave his only begotten Son is put forward as the greatest possible sacrifice. Here's a God. I mean, it's a ridiculous idea. I'm sorry to have to say. A God could have as many begotten sons or unbegotten sons as he wanted. But somehow there's only one begotten Son, and this is the greatest sacrifice that a father could give, a patriarch could give, is to sacrifice his only Son. So this is a patriarchal view that comes through even in John 3:16 and reinforces the whole patriarchal tradition of the Bible as a whole, and I'll talk about that more. Here we get back once again to the role of women in the fall of man, of humanity, and the punishment and the curse upon them, which is once again subtly but definitely reinforced by this whole notion. Let's move on and see how the patriarchy also continues or actually begins with the New Testament. Some of you who are familiar with the Bible know how the New Testament begins. The beginning of Matthew is full of begats. So-and-so begat, so-and-so begat, so-and-so begat. That's 14 generations. This one begat, begat, 14 generations. Begat, begat, David, begat, 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 Jesus. This is how the New Testament begins. Now, we could note that in Luke chapter 3, verses 23 to 38, the genealogy of Jesus, in other words, all these begats, and his ancestors, is different than in Matthew. Apparently, the God who was supposed to have divinely inspired the Bible himself couldn't keep all this genealogy straight when dictating it to the people who wrote down the Bible. So he got two different versions, one in Matthew and one in Luke. But the more serious point is that these begats are all in the service of reinforcing patriarchy. As I pointed out in a pamphlet, Liberation Without Gods, the whole thing in Matthew is an attempt to trace Jesus and his roots from Abraham, the patriarch of the Jewish people, through King David to Joseph. If you notice in Matthew, it ends with Joseph, the father of Jesus. Why Joseph? Think about that. He's the father of Jesus. Even though Joseph's seed, if you think about it, has absolutely nothing to do with Jesus. Because as we all know, Jesus was of a virgin birth. There was no Joseph seed involved. So why trace it to Joseph? Because that's the patriarchal line, the line where men count and women are invisible. So you notice that this is a history of patriarchs, an attempt to put Jesus squarely within the tradition of the patriarchs and patriarchal kings and rulers of the Jewish people. Even though Mary is Jesus' blessed mother, her seed, her lineage does not count because she is a woman. Now here's another example of something which, if you think about it, promotes patriarchy and the cruel oppression that has accompanied patriarchy for generations and centuries. This time from Jesus himself in his own words. Getting a divorce, he tells us, and remarrying, he insists, is a sin, is committing adultery. For example, this is said in Luke 16, 18, and Matthew 5, verses 31 and 32. To get a divorce and to remarry is a sin. Imagine, and unfortunately we do not have to imagine, all the suffering this has served to reinforce down through the ages, especially for women trapped in marriages that are oppressive and abusive. To get divorced is a sin. Now, there's been much written and study done to suggest that along with driving out the other people who were in the area supposedly promised to the ancient Jewish people, the Philistines and others, what really happened when the Judeo-religion took hold in that part of the what we now call the Middle East or the area of Palestine was that earlier religions, which were more earlier societies, which were more matrilineal, which traced their lineage through women, in which women did not hold such an oppressed position, and in which, in fact, there was a worship of women goddesses, at least on an equal plane with, if not above, male gods, that all this was swept away when what became the Jewish people and their religion took hold in this area. And one of the things you'll see throughout the Bible, which suggests that this may be the case, is all the polemics against the other religions, the denunciations of these religions. And when you look into it, much of it actually has to do with the fact that they had quote-unquote temple prostitutes, which were in fact people who carried out religious ceremonies. Sometimes they involved sexual acts, not always, but they were roundly and uniformly condemned in the Bible as prostitutes, whores. And all these other religions were condemned and people were slaughtered for attempting to practice them. And there is evidence to suggest that some of this had to do with the fact that the ancient Jewish religion as it formed was a patriarchal, male-dominated society and patriarchal, male-dominated religion reflecting that society and was determined to wipe out either vestiges or actual practices, things left over or actual central practices of religions in which women did not play such a subordinated and condemned role. Now, I will return to and go more fully into the essential aspects of the Christian message and doctrine a little later. But first, it is important to discuss the relation between the Christian religion and Judaism. That is, Christianity as it first developed within, and then as it separated itself from and increasingly came into hostile conflict with Judaism, and the love-hate orientation and relationship that Christianity has had toward Judaism throughout the history of Christianity from more or less its first century. Now, if you read the Bible, for example, the book of Acts, you will see that there was a struggle among the early Christian communities about their relationship to Judaism, and in particular, the Jewish laws and commandments. One way to look at it, and I think it generally reflects what you see in the Bible and in other scholarship, is there were sort of three trends that existed among the very early Christians. One associated with James, the brother of Jesus. Another one associated with Peter. And one associated with Paul, which is the one that won out. What seems to be the case is that James and those associated with him wanted to uphold most strictly the Jewish law, commandments, and traditions. Peter was kind of in the middle. We could have some bending of that, but we still had to essentially base ourselves on that. And Paul said, in essence, we've got to spread this religion among the Gentiles, among the non-Jews. And we've got to make it a much more universal religion, so we can't be so strict in insisting upon all the laws and commandments and the practices of the Jewish religion as it's been in the past. Because all these were, Christianity was a sect that developed within Judaism. And the argument was, how should it apply Judaism? That was the argument at first. And there were some very practical concerns that Paul was dealing with, and you can see some of the reasons why he won out. When they went to these communities around in what was part of the Roman Empire, a lot of them had no Jewish history and tradition. They were Gentile, non-Jewish communities. They didn't practice the dietary laws and all the other strict requirements that are in the Old Testament. And the males in particular, let's get right down on the ground, did not practice circumcision. Now, in those days, they didn't have anesthesia. They didn't have sophisticated surgical instruments. And if you went to adult males, not babies, and said, convert to Judaism, but you have to be circumcised, what you were trying to do would be very circumscribed. That was going to definitely limit the number of adults who were going to be inclined to join your religion. So Paul said, you can be circumcised in the spirit. You don't have to be circumcised in the flesh. A very wise policy on his part. And so with all the dietary rules, they loosened those up, and that enabled Christianity to spread. And this became more and more important because the bulk of the Jewish people rejected Christianity. They didn't persecute it, but they didn't accept that Jesus was the Messiah. As they thought, the Messiah was supposed to be a conquering hero that would lift the Jewish people up, not someone who was supposed to die on the cross in defeat, even though then the Christians came up with the story of resurrection to try to offset that defeat. So as more and more became clear that the Jewish people were, in their great majority, were not going to embrace Christianity, it became important to follow Paul's line, or else the religion would have died out. But as this started to happen, as this separation developed, what we see happening in the Christian communities, and as they wrote down what became the Bible, and you have to understand, the scholarship shows there were many different versions of these scriptures. It wasn't one Bible like you have now. Different people had copies, and then other people would copy it, and they'd make mistakes, and they have to go back and correct it, or they wouldn't correct it, and it would get carried down to the next generation. And different communities had different versions of these scriptures and fragments. And there were many scriptures that eventually, after Constantine basically took over the Christian religion, did not get included in the Bible. Gospels, attributed to Thomas, the disciple, for example, or the Gospel of Peter, and so on and so forth. So what happened was, as these Christian communities began to try to forge their own identity, coming out of Judaism and moving away from it, we see increasingly that they are turning against the Jews. And this is where we get the passion story that gets written into the scriptures 50 and more years after the time when Jesus is supposed to have died. This is when we see in Matthew, for example, the statement that a curse will be on the Jews forever because they, rather than the Roman authorities, have now been blamed for the killing of Jesus. You remember the story. It's in the passion thing, everything. The Roman emperor and the Roman authority said, let him go. You know, Pontius Pilate, I don't, what's the problem here? There's no, I don't see anything wrong. But the Jewish authority said, no, you know, crucify him. And then even one of these Jewish authorities says, a curse will be upon us for what we've done here. This got to be increasingly put into the Christian history and the Christian scripture. Now, you have to understand, it's one thing, and this is a very important point, it's one thing for there to be rivalry between what were originally, you know, different Jewish sects, and then even between Christianity as it moved out of Judaism and those who remained in Judaism. It's one thing for that to be, that kind of rivalry to exist when neither one has any real power over the other and cannot inflict any real consequences on the other. But as we'll see, as Christianity became the religion of the Roman Empire, everything changed very dramatically and with very dire consequences for not only Jews, but pagans and everybody else who refused to adopt Christianity. But the fact is that although Christianity moved out from Judaism, became a separate religion, Christianity could not and cannot free itself from its foundation in Judaism. It can't just leave that behind and say we don't want anything to do with that, for reasons that I'll get into more, but they have to do with the fact that Jesus' whole bona fides, his claim to legitimacy as the Messiah, is rooted in the old Jewish scriptures. So they couldn't just cast all that off. But at the same time, Christianity increasingly developed an antagonism with Judaism and with Jews, even as it kept its foundation in what's called the Old Testament in the Bible. And as I've said, as Christianity grew into a religion separate from Judaism, this antagonism, this hostile conflict, not only grew more intense, but it took on a different and more ominous and dangerous dimension. As Christianity became the official state religion of the Roman Empire, as it did not long after Constantine, and the official or all but official religion of other empires and oppressive systems down through the centuries, we see that Christian zealots, but also the Christian church itself, encouraged and played an active part in segregating in ghettos and discriminating against Jews, condemning them in the most vile terms, and encouraging and organizing pogroms and mass murders of Jewish people time and time again. And this is not simply a thing of the past. It has persisted down to the present age and finds expression even today in things like the Passion of the Christ, which are stirring up exactly those kind of emotions. And this is not just the personal project of Mel Gibson, it should be noted, but has found encouragement and support, directly or indirectly, overtly or more subtly, from the Pope, as well as Protestant Christian fundamentalists and Christian fascists like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and others with connections right up to the highest levels of the U.S. government. And this at the same time, this is how perverse these people are and how strange the world can be. This is going on at the same time as the reactionary Christian fundamentalists and the reactionary Christian fundamentalist president and his administration provide the most uncritical and unflinching support and backing to the state of Israel and the many ways in which Israel has not only robbed the Palestinian people of their homeland and continues to viciously oppress them, but also the ways in which Israel serves as a military outpost and instrument of the U.S. empire in the strategic region of the Middle East and even other far-flung parts of the globe, very far removed from geographically from Israel, such as Latin America and East Asia, where Israel does dirty work for U.S. imperialism through its secret police and in other ways. Now, this is a very acute contradiction for these Christian fascists, as we call them. Here on the one hand, they condemn the Jews as the Christ killers. On the other hand, they have to fervently support Israel as an instrument of the U.S. empire. Well, how do they handle this? As I pointed out in an article called The Pyramid of Power, which appeared a couple of months ago in our newspaper, The Revolutionary Worker, one of the main ways they do it is to say, look in the book of Revelation, the final book in the New Testament. According to their interpretation of Revelation, the second coming depends on the state of Israel being founded and cannot happen if Israel does not exist, isn't reconstituted. So therefore, if the state of Israel is destroyed, the whole second coming will get thrown back. And this is what they tell their followers who hate the Jews as Christ killers, but now are blindly soldiers in defense of everything Israel does. Yet at the same time, it is very important to keep in mind that in the worldview of these Christian fundamentalists, the choice for the Jews with the approach of the second coming will be simply this: convert to Christianity or be condemned to eternal damnation. So it is worthwhile then to step back and review briefly the big change that occurred from the time Christianity became the favored and then the official religion of the rulers of the Roman Empire. In the 4th century, about 1700 years ago, Constantine defeated various rivals and then finally his rival, Maxentius, in a battle that enabled him to consolidate his position as the sole ruler of the Roman Empire. Right before that battle against Maxentius, who was a rival military leader, according to the mythology that was reconstructed later, Constantine, before entering battle, all of a sudden saw in the sky a cross-like figure. And the words, "By this sign ye shall conquer." And thereby he went into war with the cross as his symbol and was victorious. And on this basis, he then adopted Christianity, although not completely and wholly. But he adopted Christianity and became the iron hand determining the shape of Christianity from that time on. Now, the historian F.E. Peters, in his sweeping survey of the legacy and influence of ancient Greek culture, a book called The Harvest of Hellenism, made this very important observation. Very few of the incredible variety of cults and beliefs followed in the Roman Empire possessed much vitality in the 4th or 5th century, that is, after the birth of Christ, or in the Common Era, as they say now. But, he goes on, the difference between a dying religion and a dead religion is considerable. And to achieve this latter, that is, the killing off of all religions except Christianity within the Roman Empire, increasingly stringent measures had to be taken. The ideal of killing off all religions except Christianity was, of course, the churches, but it was shared and executed by the state. As the resources of the Roman state were once directed toward the extirpation, that is, the wiping out of Christianity, so they were now turned against heretics and pagans. And we should add Jews as well. And in fact, which are among the heretics, and in fact, the repression carried out by the Christian Roman Empire was much more consistent and systematic and far more extreme and relentless than what had been directed against Christians when theirs was not the official religion, but a more marginal and at times persecuted sect under Roman rule. We always hear about the Christians in the lions and the Christians being thrown to the lions and all the other horrible things that happened. Yes, that did happen from time to time, not consistently in the Roman Empire. It varied from emperor to emperor. But that was as nothing compared to the persecution of people of other religious beliefs once Christianity became the official religion and you were not allowed to have any other religion within the Roman Empire. And all this is spelled out more than I can go into it here by Edward Gibbon, the classical Enlightenment scholar, in his book, famous book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, as well as in a more recent book by a guy named James Carroll, Constantine's Sword. So you can imagine, and I've touched on, the consequences since that time for the Jews and more broadly for all those who refused or resisted adopting Christianity and the dictates of the church and the state behind it. Now let me turn now to other people in our own times and our own place who are trying to force Christianity as the official state religion, namely those we call Christian fascists in the U.S., the reactionary Christian fundamentalists. Why do we call them that? Isn't that an exaggeration? Are they really fascists? Well, I'll get into what they believe and you can judge for yourself and what they're trying to implement. But they want to see a religious rule in this country, a rule that essentially throws out the separation of church and state, or not essentially, entirely throws out the separation in church and state, insists that this is a Christian nation, and forces a fundamentalist view of Christianity, which contains all these things I've been referring to from the Bible, as the official basis for law in this country and for rule in this country. They include people like Attorney General Ashcroft, who's an open supporter of white supremacy among everything else, as is Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and the rest of them. If that's not fascism, it'll do. So let's talk then about the traditions and traditional morality they insist on, and want to enforce on all of society. By the way, one thing I wanted to ask is, have you ever noticed that in the United States, the Bible Belt is also the lynching belt? It is not accidental that those areas which are the hotbeds and main bastions of Christian fundamentalism in the U.S. are also the areas where the lynching was most egregious, where the oppression of black people was most horrific, because the two go hand in hand. This is something I spell out more fully in a book I wrote called Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones. But this has been the history of the U.S., and it's true today. Now let's look at some of the things that these Christian fascists, as we rightly call them, want to enforce in this society. I've talked about how slavery, rape, the slaughter and plunder of people with different religious traditions is upheld throughout this, particularly the Old Testament of the Bible. Let's just look at a few examples. And if you'll indulge me, I'm going to read from the Bible. This is from the book of Numbers, chapter 31. When the Israelites encounter and go to war with the Midianites and defeat them in battle, and then they come back and report to Moses. And reading from verse 13 on, here's what it says. Moses, Eleazar the priest, and all the leaders of the congregation went to meet them, that is the returning soldiers, outside the camp. Moses became angry with the officers of the army and the commanders of thousands and the commanders of hundreds who had come from service in the war. Moses said to them, "Have you allowed the women to live?" Speaking of the Midianites. "These women here, on Balaam's advice, made the Israelites act treacherously against the Lord in the affair of Peor. So that plague came among the congregation of the Lord. Now therefore, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known a man by sleeping with him. But all the young girls who have not known a man by sleeping with him, keep alive for yourselves." And then a little later it goes on, turning over to verse 31. "Then Moses and Eleazar, the priest, did it as the Lord had commanded Moses. The booty remaining from the spoil that the troops had taken totaled 675,000 sheep. Listen to the list. 675,000 sheep, 72,000 oxen, 61,000 donkeys, and 32,000 persons in all, women who had not known a man by sleeping with him." Now this is the Lord of the Bible insisting upon this and praising it when it happens and carrying this out through his instruments, the leaders like Moses. Or you all have heard about Joshua and the Battle of Jericho. Joshua at the Battle of Jericho, 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 Joshua at the Battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. But what people don't focus on so much is what happened after the walls came tumbling down. All the people of Jericho were slaughtered under the Lord's command. Here's what it says in the Bible. In particular, Joshua 6, verses 17 to 19, and especially verse 21. "Then they devoted to destruction by the edge of the sword all in the city of Jericho, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkeys." And you can read the same kind of bloodthirsty thing throughout the Old Testament. For example, not just in the first five books, the so-called Mosaic books of the Old Testament, but in something like Isaiah. When you leave your go home and open your Bible, if you have one, and read books 12 to 14, chapters 12 to 14 in Isaiah, it's full of what we referred to in that leaflet, calls to slaughter the Babylonians and other people, to wipe them off the earth or turn them into slaves, to rape the women repeatedly, and to bash in the heads of the babies. Or look at the Psalms, for example, Psalm 137. Here is how Psalm 137 ends. It is speaking of the oppression of the Jewish people carried off into exile by the Babylonians and the revenge they will take. "O daughter Babylon, you devastator, happy shall they be who pay you back what you have done to us. Happy shall they be who take your little ones and dash them against the rock."